So here we are. Last stretch. My book says the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And, you know, it's easy to especially being involved with a group like this, to get a lot of information, to know the right words, and to have a good idea of what the theory is all about what the book says and about what we're supposed to do. You know, and it is another thing to live it. Watch my feet, don't watch my lips. And for me, I have to see that there's a way of life that I have to maintain in order to not drink again. The statistics for people that stay sober for any long period of time are kind of low. I've heard various amounts stated. I've heard some people have said 3%. I've heard 6%. But the general thing that I hear is about 5% stay sober for any reasonable period of time. Right? I've also heard people say in meetings that there's as many ways to work the steps as there is people in it. You ever heard that? As many ways to work the steps as there's people in it. But based on the statistics, you don't want to be doing what 95% of them are doing. Right? And all I know is there's a certain passion of people that get into this stuff and follow the way of life that the book illustrates. And if you've gotten to this point and you've finished amends, you've come a long way, probably. And the problem is, though, a spiritual path is not a destination. It's a path. Right? And there's certain things that the book suggests to me. Not only to maintain that condition, but also to grow it. Because it's not just about, 10 and 11 are not just maintenance steps. They're maintenance and growth steps. And there's some promises here in the ninth step. And what I usually do with the nine step promises is wait till someone's about halfway through with the nine step before we look at them together. And usually by the time you're halfway through the ninth step, you can read these from a place of relating to them, usually. Where in the beginning we related to them much different. In the beginning, what I related to was something much different. And that was the reverse of the promises, of the nine-step promises, which was when I was painstaking about my drinking, I was amazed that I knew a new freedom and a new happiness when I was drunk. And when I was drunk, I didn't regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. When I was drunk, I comprehended the word serenity and I knew peace. When I was drunk, no matter how far down the scale I've gone, I could see how my experience could benefit others, whether you wanted to hear it or not. When I was drinking, the feeling of uselessness and self-pity disappeared. When I was drinking, I lost interest in selfish things and I gained interest in my fellows. I'd buy them all the drink. Because self-seeking slipped away, right? When I was drinking, my whole attitude and outlook upon life changed. And when I was drinking, the fear of people and of economic insecurity left me. When I was drinking, I intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. And I realized that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. And that's where I started. So to get to this point where I could realize that I've found a life of ease and comfort, not from alcohol, but from access to power, from getting brought to a place where I have some sort of reliance on God. Goes on to say that these promises are fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. And they'll always materialize if I work for them. They'll always materialize if I work for them. And I believe that's working towards clearing away the things that block me from God and other people. And that's where 10 comes in, and 11. Now, there's a lot of, sometimes I create a little controversy when it comes to 10, because I don't talk about writing inventory in 10. I get asked a lot of questions about stuff, because I seem to get a lot of people that like to dig in and just kind of break down what the book is really talking about. And one day somebody came up to me a long time ago and said, what's the difference between here, where it says we continue to take personal inventory, and in the 11th step, when it talks about in the nightly review, where it says, where was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Because they both sound like an inventory. And they asked, was Bill just being redundant? So in looking over this, what I've come to believe is that you can draw a line in between 10 and 11. They do overlap. Many times I'm doing 10 and 11 together. But I believe what 10 is talking about is my relationship with you and how I'm interacting with the people around me. And 11 is my interaction with God. And the way 10 and 11 overlaps is I have to bring my relationship with God into my relationship with you. Right. Here it says, we can, in the 10th step, it says we to continue to take personal inventory and to continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. It doesn't say we write inventory necessarily. And I believe that what it's saying here is I'm continuing to take my inventory at this point, not yours. It's sort of like an inventory without your name in the first column. Right? This is what happened, and this is how it's affecting me. Because by this point, hopefully I've written enough inventory that I know it's really not about you. Right? But it's about how it's affecting me. Right? And again, I said, I don't usually write that because I consider the 10th step something I'm doing while I'm still talking to you. And hopefully I'm doing it before I respond to what you've just done. Or what you just said. Because what my book says here is that I continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. It doesn't say I wait for it. It's telling me to watch. You know? And watching is a great spiritual exercise. Because when I'm spiritually in a good place, I'm looking through a different set of eyes. I'm looking at the world around me through a different set of eyes. Right? Trying to live a particular way. It says, when these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Right? It always reminds me of a t-shirt that I read. We made a list of people we resented and asked God to remove them. One of these days I got to get one of those shirts. Discuss them with someone immediately. We discuss them with someone immediately and make amends quickly if we've harmed them. And we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we could help. Love and tolerance of others is our code. So, again, I can't always effectively say the right things or react the right way. I'm not perfect. Right? I guess I still need to do this. You know, maybe after doing, I've done it for about 16 or 17 years, out of my 18 years of sobriety. Maybe after I've done it a few more years, I won't have to work at it, or maybe I could do it a little bit better, I should say. Maybe not. Maybe I'll always need God's help. That's, again, where the 11th step is going to come in. We'll talk about that in a minute. There's some question? Yeah. About talking to someone immediately? Mm-hmm. Right. Well, that's pretty much how I look at it. If I say something or do something and my intuition tells me I shouldn't have done that, then I will try to say something right away to the person I did it with or did it to or said it to. Well, there's also been situations where I've had an interaction with somebody, realized that I might have done something hurtful, and turned to someone that was with me and said, did that sound bad? Did that sound like out of line? Right. I consider it more on the fly. Right. There's some great promises in the 10th step. You don't hear about them as much in meetings as you do the 9th step promises. It says, we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. Remember earlier on, Bill uses the term to relate to his insanity. It's like touching a hot stove. We react sanely and normally, and we will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude towards liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. Hasn't most of our thought and effort not been on alcohol or trying to stop, but on other things? Right? We are not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we had been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. And that's a great promise, that the problem has been removed. Now, what I have to remember, though, is the problem, my problem with alcohol has been removed, but my alcoholism hasn't. It says, we're neither cocky nor afraid, that's our experience. That's how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. Right? So what happens if we don't keep in fit spiritual condition? You're right, we're cocky and afraid. It says it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Now, if you don't know what a laurel wreath is what they hang around a horse after it's won a race. Resting on my laurels is resting on the idea that I think I know everything there is to know here and that I've got all there is to get. It says we're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We are not cured of alcoholism. Right? Now that kind of hangs people up and it becomes an argument with some people because some people like to say I'm a recovered alcoholic. And then some people's argument is, well, it says right here, you're not cured of alcoholism. And I think it's important to understand what they say I'm cured of. In the beginning of the book, it specifically says, I recover from a hopeless state of mind and body. I recover physically. As long as I don't ever drink again, I'll never suffer this physical craving to drink more. And if I've recovered mentally, that means the obsessions to drink are gone, which are different than the thought of drink. Obsession is the idea that outweighs all other ideas. The insanity that hits where that ultimately takes me to the first drink, and then I lose control. So recovery just means I'm not drinking and I'm not insane about it, right? But what I have to understand is there's a third factor here that we looked at also in the first step. In the beginning, I talked about having a spiritual malady that sets up a condition conducive for the obsessions to return. Right? We talked about that in the beginning. And it never says in the book here that spiritual condition, the spiritual malady, ever leaves me. What does happen is the spiritual malady gets suppressed. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. Right? Every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. So here it's talking about bringing the vision of God into all of our activities. Not just praying in the morning, not just praying at night, but it's suggesting that you bring God into your life during the day. I talk about doing an 18-hour meditation. I'm sorry, a 16-hour meditation. The other 8 hours I'm sleeping. Okay, these are thoughts that must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. Here it's saying that I have the ability to use my will. Right? There's plenty of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that don't think that an alcoholic has the potential to think for himself. Right? You see all those little posters on at Alano clubs, and people talking about alcoholic thinking, right? Like that's like a condition that an alcoholic has to live with forever. Right? To me, alcoholic thinking is thinking that takes me back to the drink, not just bad behavior or stupid behavior, right? Now, here it says, I have the ability to use my mind, but there's a proper way to do that, right? You know, what if I bring God into all of my activities and be who God would have me be, right? Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and power from Him who has all knowledge. I'm sorry. Much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction from Him who has all knowledge and power. If we have carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of His Spirit into us. To some extent, we become God-conscious. We have begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action. Here it calls the God-consciousness a vital sixth sense. So we have five physical senses, right? What is, I always miss one of them at least. Sight, smell, hearing, touch, feel, taste. I always screw that up. And I've always trusted those more than anything. Right? Right? If I see it, I'm going to believe it. Right? If I smell it, I know it's there. My physical senses are something that I don't question very much. But hasn't the fourth step and some of the work we've done to this point showed me that I can't necessarily trust what I thought I saw? Right? And it's talking about developing this vital sixth sense, consciousness of the presence of a God that can work in my life. So now it's going to talk to us about step 11. It says step 11 suggests prayer and meditation. Now, if you look up the word prayer in the dictionary, you could find like two pages with definitions for prayer. So you have to look at the context it's used in. And I believe the context that it's used in here is asking God. And meditation has taken on a whole new meaning today. Meditation to a lot of people means silence. But in order for it to be silence, it should have said silent meditation. And it doesn't. So the definition that best fits the meditation here is directed thought. If it's silent meditation, I'm directing my thought to silence. If it's contemplative meditation, I'm directing my thoughts to some contemplation, which is more what they're talking about here, because it's going to give me some things to direct my thoughts towards. So what it's saying here is, step 11 suggests asking God to direct my thinking. It says we shouldn't be shy on this matter of prayer. Now, for many years, I read that as shy being like afraid to do it in front of people. But that's kind of out of context. And what I realized, what they're saying here is, shy is like, you know, one shy of a dozen, right? Or 3 inches shy of a foot. Right? It says we shouldn't be short on this matter of prayer. Better men than we are using it constantly. Right? That's more the context that it's in, right? It works if we have the proper attitude and work at it. It would be easy to be vague about this matter, yet we believe we can make some definite and valuable suggestions. So now they're going to tell me what the meditation is going to look like. Yet, so many people think that me included, I thought I was going to have to go learn some kind of spiritual path in order to do this. I thought that prayer and meditation, then I was going to have to join a church, learn how to meditate properly, the right way to sit. Right? But when you understand what it's saying here is this next paragraph, you could almost bottom line it and ask yourself, how did I behave today, and did I bring God into all of my activities? Right? But to start here, it feels almost backwards because it says when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. But if we start at the end of the 11th step, it tells me what I'm reviewing. So I'm going to start over here in the next page at the bottom of 87 where it says, as we go through the day, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. That's because I'm going to trust that God, the Father, is going to provide what I need if I turn to Him. We constantly remind ourselves we're no longer running the show. Right? God's going to direct my life. Right? Humbly saying to ourselves many times each day, Thy will be done. I will be who God would have me be. That's the principal and agent relationship. Those are the things we talked about in the third step. It's a vision of, when we talked about the vision in the third step of a way to live in the future, that we made a decision on a way of life. Right? In the third step, we said we were going to live this way. Right? Now we're supposed to be doing it. So when you look at the nightly review from that perspective, right, and look at the things that it says to look at, constructively looking at my day, was I resentful, selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Do I owe an apology? Have I kept something to myself which should have been discussed with another person? Was I kind and loving towards all? What could I have done better? Was I thinking of myself most of the time, or was I thinking of what we could do for others or what we could pack into the stream of life? We must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, or morbid reflection, because that would diminish our usefulness to others. Right? So it's basically how did I move through the day? Did I do the 11-step pause? Did I bring God into all of my activities? And when you look at it from that perspective, the next sentence makes a little bit more sense. So after making a review, we ask God's forgiveness and inquire what corrective measures should be taken. That always kind of hung me up as far as, you know, what does it mean I have to ask God's forgiveness? And it goes back to that relationship idea. It's like, if you went all day without talking to your girlfriend, right, or ignoring her, right, do you think that it would be in line to ask her forgiveness? Right? If you treated her like she wasn't there? Right? This is like any other relationship. In order for me to have a relationship, I have to treat it like it's there. Right? So, this is on awakening. Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. We considered our plans for the day. Now, they say that Bill didn't like saying the same thing twice the same way. Right? So he already talked about the 11th step being about prayer and meditation. And my definition, as far as asking God to direct my thinking, right, direct my thoughts. Here it says, before we begin, we ask God to direct our thinking. Right? It's prayer and meditation. Especially asking that it be divorced from self-pity, dishonest, or self-seeking motives. Under these conditions, we can employ our mental faculties with assurance, for after all, God gave us brains to use. Our thought life will be placed on a much higher plane when our thinking is cleared of wrong motives. Right? So in the morning, I remind myself that my relationship with God is something that I want to be conscious of. Asking God to direct my thinking, to direct my day. So, basically, rather than read all of this to you, which a lot of the people here probably read it many times themselves, I'd like to just explain how I would do this in practice, at least how I started off doing it for years. I've mixed it up a little bit just to keep it fresh. But initially what I tell people to do, what I tell them to do is when they wake up in the morning, to sit in silent meditation for a while and to try to start with whatever they can start with, 5 or 10 minutes, and then try to pick it up if they can. And to start reading from On Awakening till the end of the chapter. Right? And consider what it says. And then all through the day, practice bringing God into all other activities. Right? Consciously practice getting used to bringing God into everything. And then at night, to sit quietly. If they can do another sitting with silence, it's a good idea. Right? And to start reading at the beginning of the 10th step, up until the nightly review, and then consider what it says. And the nightly review, I've seen people break all of those things into different questions. Was I resentful? Was I selfish? Was I dishonest? And they go through that whole section, you know, looking at each one of those parts. You know, I did that for years. And there's only so long you could do the same thing and read the same paragraph over and over. Right? And it got as simple as me looking at, just scanning my day, asking God to direct my thoughts and show me what I need to see about my day. Another great exercise during the nightly review is to go back to page 52 and ask myself, did I bring God into my personal relationships today? Did I bring God into my emotional conditions today? Right? If there was misery and depression, did I turn to God for help with that? Right? I go through each one of those things on page 52 asking if I brought God into my life today, in those situations, into my fears, into the feelings of uselessness, into the unhappiness, right? Or did I ignore that commitment I made for that relationship. Because if I could go through page 52 and see that I completely ignored the idea of bringing God into those things, those areas of my life, then obviously I've just completely ignored this relationship that I've made this commitment to, that I said I want. And I can't say that I've done it perfectly over the years. I can't say that just that I've got reached this spiritual hilltop that I don't have like the red phone to God. Right? You know, but my life is different today. My life is you know, I came into this program completely turned off the idea about the idea that I was going to need to find some kind of God in my life, right? And now it's one of the most important parts of my life. This process took me to a place, took me to an access to that power, right? Showed me how to use the power in my life. So, the last paragraph in this section says, we alcoholics are undisciplined, so we let God discipline us in this simple way we've just outlined. But this is not all. There's action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. So, that's really what this is all about. For me, you know, all this 10 and 11 stuff, you know, I hear some people talking about how long they're sitting in meditation and talking about their great spiritual practice. Sometimes when the idea of meditation or spirituality comes in as the topic for a meeting, you'll hear people talk about their yoga, they'll talk about their Buddhist practice, they'll talk about all this other stuff and never touch on what it says here, right? I think that a good reference for this is on page 87, where it says, circumstances warrant we ask our wives or friends to join us in our morning meditation. If we belong to a religious denomination which requires definite morning devotion, we attend to that also, not instead. Also, right? So in other words, it's nice that you have a yoga practice, but it's not our common solution, right? It's the thing that separates you from some people here. It's just, you know, from early in my sobriety, when I didn't understand what this was about, there was people that would come in and talk about, you know, like Jesus and all this stuff and all, you know, and it's like, it's fine for them, and there's groups that's what they're about. But it's their path and not everybody's path. It's not necessarily AA's common solution. And I think that being an attraction to people that are new to the meeting does become important. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that the newcomer is the most important person in the room. You hear that in rooms too. But if you really understand what the first tradition is talking about, AA is most important. The group's conscious is second, right? And individuals follow closely after, is what it says. Because the group, AA has to survive, and the group has to survive in order for there to be a forum for people, for the newcomer to even show up. And so, although the newcomer is not the most important person in the room, that doesn't make them unimportant, okay? But it doesn't make it more important than the format. I don't know if I made enough point of that. Anyway, but all of this work that I've done what it has done is it brought me to a place where I can be of maximum service to alcoholics, right, and to God. In order for AA to survive and for the 12 steps to survive, I think we have a responsibility to understand what the 12 steps are about. And we have a responsibility for the message that we carry. When I was new, I had a lot of trouble finding someone who could take me through the 12 steps. Right? And that's sort of sad in a 12-step program to find it hard to find someone that knew the 12 steps. So I believe that we have an individual responsibility to understand what the 12 steps are about and to carry that message, to pass that on. And what I found was is when I had a message that I trusted, and I'm not saying that mine is the only way, the only message that should be done. I mean, there's plenty of people that use the Big Book in various ways. And I think as long as you're using the Big Book, you can't be too far off, right? But I don't think you need to pull from other programs, you know, from hospital programs. There's not a lot that I had to make up. It's all in the Big Book. And I found that when I really had a program, when I understood the program outlined in the book, and I carried that message, I had a lot of trust in what I was presenting, and I got a lot of trust from the people I was working with, what I was presenting. And when you're sitting down with another alcoholic, and you're talking about their first step, right, and you're talking about their second step, and their agnosticism, and you're talking about in the third step, how they play God, right? And now, with time, having gone through all this, and I'm starting to see little snippets of me, of that behavior still in my life, right? And sometimes, working with others, you must have sometimes seen it. You're saying something, and you're going, sheesh, I'm doing that right now. Right? And you're seeing how that's kind of like checking your own behavior, right? You know, it keeps you human if you see it. You know? It makes me remember I still need God. Right? And I don't know sometimes who's getting more out of that relationship when I'm working with someone. Right? It's turned out to be the best part of this program, working with others. Yet, there's a lot of people that completely miss that part of it. I've known people with a lot of time and who haven't worked with people, you know, more than a couple of people throughout their whole sobriety. And then there's the mad dogs that can't get enough of them. But, you know, sometimes we go out to dinner after a meeting, and there'll be like four generations of sponsorship. Somebody I sponsored, somebody that they sponsored, and somebody they sponsor. And that's not uncommon in my group, in my circle. I think we were talking about it the other day, our last home group meeting. There was three generations of sponsorship just sharing. Right? Could have been four. Right? And again, that's not something that's common in some groups. But we have a common solution. We found a common solution in this book. And it's a powerful message, and people are attracted to it. And you see people's lives change. You know, it kind of starts off, when you meet somebody, it's like, start working with them, and they're still in maybe a program or something, and they're coming up to you, and when you just to kind of let you know where they're at, they're saying, you know, the therapist at the program over here is saying I might need to be on medication because I'm depressed. And I say, okay, well, let's look at this. You know, you're in a program, sleeping in a bunk bed with five other people in the room. Your family doesn't want to talk to you. You've lost your job. You have no car. All right? And you're depressed. I say, I think you're in a pretty good place, because if you weren't depressed, I think you'd need medication. You know? And then you dig in and you do this work, and a year later, You know, they, you know, they got the car, they got the girlfriend, they got the place to live, they got all this stuff, and it's like, you know, you watch this transformation of a person's life right in front of you, you know, and you know that it wasn't, you know, I could not do that for them. All I did is share with them what was shared with me, right? And you see this miracle happen in front of your eyes. It's this transformation of this person's life, right? And I get to see that over and over and over again. That there's a simple, reproducible program outlined in this book that saves lives and turns lives around. And, you know, I don't know where else or what other program you can get that. I mean, maybe there is, but I'm not aware of another place that has that kind of result. I'm sure some people can go to church and just get it, right? That was not my thing. If you can go somewhere else and have a transformation in your life, that's great, right? But this is what I know. This is what worked for me, right? And I've seen it work over and over and again. You know, I have an experience with the power of God all around me. I have proof that there's a power that can work in people's lives, right? And you know, and that helps me have faith in that power, right? Because that's really what I always wanted. I said, show me proof, right? Show me proof that there's a God, right? And in the past, I was so closed off to that, I couldn't see it. But you know, now I just look around my life, and it's all around me. So I want to thank you guys for listening to me all weekend and for inviting me out here. Now for the long ride back. Hope it's not too long. All right. So, thanks.